On today's episode of Locked On MLB, I'm going to pay tribute to two players who had glory moments wearing the Chicago Cubs uniform. Neither will probably make the Hall of Fame. And you know what? That's okay. This is Locked On MLB.
You are Locked On MLB. Your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans. Welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. Today's episode is being dropped on Sunday, the 16th day of January, 2022. Thanks so much for making Locked On MLB your first listen, as we're available on all your free podcasting platforms. Why don't you make your second listen be Locked On Bets with your boy Q, and expert analysis from Lee Sterling. I'm sure they got a lot to say about the NFL playoffs, a lot more than I do. That being said, I'm probably going to watch a couple of the games because they tend to be fun. You can follow us on Twitter, Locked On MLB Pod, same handle for Instagram. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. I had a very crazy, busy week this last week, so I didn't get to record as many original podcasts as I would like, but I did manage to post three of pretty fun episodes, including one with Dave Feldman, one with Janice Scurio. We had some fun last week. I didn't completely go AWOL, but I confess some of those were taped ahead of time, recording this one over the weekend. I did not get a chance to bid farewell to a player who was one of my favorite players in all of baseball, and I found impossibly easy to root for, and that was John Lester. John Lester finished his 16-year career. He finished it with the St. Louis Cardinals. He was on the team that made the wild card game. He didn't get to pitch in the wild card game because, remember, they lost on the walk-off home run, and the Cardinals had that wild winning streak that put them into position to get to the wild card game against Los Angeles. But he had a fantastic career, and one that I followed really, really closely. He pitched 9 years with the Red Sox, came up blazing in 2006, and then had his cancer diagnosis and came back from cancer to pitch the end of the 2007 season, where he won four games, didn't lose any, pitched well, and came out of the bullpen in the playoffs and pitched game four of the 2007 World Series against Colorado and pitched well, pitched in the sixth inning in Colorado, and the Red Sox won the game. He got himself a World Series ring. But his real coming out part, I mean, right there, he dynamic start to his career, a World Series champion by age 23, beat the Big C. All these things made him just so easy to root for. And then in 2008, it became more than a feel-good story, but he became really one of the best pitchers in the American League for a period of time. He led the league in shutouts in 2008, and one of them on my dad's birthday. On May 19th, 2008, he threw a no-hitter, and that was just a tremendous moment. He became a workhorse for the Red Sox, a real old-school workhorse, giving 200 innings year in and year out. Yes, he was part of the fried chicken beer brigade down the stretch in 2011, the 1 year during that stretch where he didn't get to 200 innings. Didn't pitch well down the stretch. Actually had a good year, or an all-star year in 2011, just like the entire Red Sox starting pitching staff fell apart. And he had a bad, very bad 2012 season, although he did manage to pitch over 200 innings. Came back with a vengeance in 2013 and was the Red Sox ace in that playoff series, when they were in the division series, league championship series, and World Series. He won his one game against Tampa, pitching into the eighth inning in the division series. He won one game against Detroit, and then he made a case to be the World Series MVP, winning both of his starts, going deep in both of his starts. His ERA was below 0.6, absolutely dominated the St. Louis Cardinals. David Ortiz had a slightly better World Series. And then Lester became part of a long parade, and someday I'm going to make a 25-man roster of people who should have been a Red Sox for life. He should have been a Red Sox for life. They could not come up with a contract. Red Sox, one of the richest organizations in baseball, and they wound up trading him to Oakland in 2014 when he was pending free agency. I have to say, because I was living in the Bay Area at the time, and I followed that 2014 team that the Oakland A's had very, very closely, and I was rooting very hard for that. I wanted that team to win the World Series of all the playoff teams. Oddly, it was the Giants who wound up winning it, but the A's were an insanely likable team. And at the time of the John Lester trade, the A's were the best team in baseball. And it looked like everything was clicking for them to finally get over the playoff hump. I have to say the John Lester for Yoenis Cespedes trade, the trade was officially John Lester and Johnny Gomes for Yoenis Cespedes, has to be one of the single strangest reactions to a trade I've ever seen in my life, because nobody liked the trade. Red Sox fans were furious that John Lester, the homegrown ace who should have been re-signed, the Red Sox have the money to re-sign someone like John Lester, pitchers who are, you know, 200 inning pitchers with World Series pedigrees, multiple World Series pedigrees, don't really grow on trees. And to suddenly be cheap and let him skedaddle was, you know, got people angry. And they got Yoenis Cespedes, who was a all-star slugger. And I thought, like, okay, I mean, I like Cespedes, but I would rather have an ace. Meanwhile, A's fans were absolutely apoplectic, because Cespedes was one of the single most popular players on the Oakland A's at the time. And when Lester, and I kept saying, you guys don't understand, John Lester's a great, great pitcher. He's, you know, he's going to be that pitcher that come playoff time, he's a big name pitcher. You want him starting that big game for you. And there was just, people were, you know, my Oakland A's fans just did not want to hear it. Now, the thing that didn't make life easy for John Lester, even though he came in his first game with the A's, he pitched very well. A's won the game, okay, against Kansas City in a cruel foreshadowing of things that would eventually take place. At the time, the A's had the single best record in baseball. They were 67-42 with a 6.15 winning percentage. That was better than the Angels. That was better than the Dodgers. So still things were looking up for the Oakland A's, who had a two-game lead over a very good Angels team. After that game, the A's finished the season with the second worst record in the American League. They played sub-400 ball the rest of the way. Only the Diamondbacks and White Sox played worse than the A's after the John Lester trade. Now, correlation does not always equal causation, but so many A's fans pointed, we're the best team in baseball before that trade, and now we're the second worst team in the American League after the trade. That trade's a disaster. And the A's barely made the playoffs. They were the visiting team in the wild card game. But I kept trying to tell my A's friends, you don't understand. You want Lester on the mound. You want Lester on the mound in the big game. You're in the postseason. Can the ball to Lester? To my credit, Lester pitched well for the first seven innings of that game, the wild card game against the Royals. If Bob Melvin had said, hey, you gave us seven and handed the ball over to the strong bullpen, including friend of the podcast, Sean Doolittle, Lester would have won the game. The A's still had a lead with one out and nobody on in the bottom of the ninth. They also had a lead with one out and nobody on in the bottom of the, I think it was the 14th. They blew both of those leads. And the thing that A's fans just cannot forgive John Lester is he just has this weird thing. And I never understood it. I don't think anybody ever understood it. He just couldn't throw over to first. He just could not hold a runner on. Now, in the age of Moneyball, when nobody steals bases, that really doesn't come up. In the steroid era, and we'll get to that in a second, in the steroid era where nobody's stolen bases, that's not a skill that really matters unless you're playing a team like the 2014 or 2015 Kansas City Royals, who have jackrabbits on their team and constantly were trying to steal it and rattle them. And they rallied with all those stolen bases and the A's wound up losing the game. Then he skedaddles via free agency. It's the one thing in his resume. If he had just learned to throw to first, he would be beloved by Red Sox fans, beloved by A's fans, and beloved by Cub fans. Now, I also remember that when he became a free agent after the wild card game in 2014, many Red Sox fans, including me, were going to whatever house of worship we could find, lighting candles and saying, please resign with the Red Sox, please resign with the Red Sox, please resign with the Red Sox. But, you know, he was obviously going to go to the highest bidder because the Red Sox didn't show him any loyalty. And as it turned out, he signed with the Cubs. And he pitched for the Cubs for 6 years, and about three or four of them were quite good. For those of us who still like to look at wins, he led the league in victories in 2018. He was the National League Championship Series co-MVP in 2016. Pitched well out of the bullpen in that Game 7 against the Cleveland Indians. And think about that. If you had gone back in time and said, hey, there's a guy who would have won a World Series title with the Cubs and also have two World Series titles with the Boston Red Sox, that would have seemed, you know, physiologically impossible. But alas, that's exactly what he did. And I want to talk a little bit about his legacy and the way that people who are not A's fans are discussing the career of him. But look at it's an absolute surefire bet that if you had John Lester on your team, you were going to do well. He had that effect on teams. And if you're going to make any bets, go to Bet Online, which remains the number one spot for all the best sports wagering action for 2022. It's a new year and a new updated desktop and mobile website. To sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit, just use promo code LOCKEDON to get started. From football, basketball, hockey, boxing, UFC, right to your favorite Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers for 2022. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports. BetOnline is where the game starts. Now, more than one person asked me, is John Lester in the Hall of Fame? Is Lester a Hall of Fame? Is Lester a Hall of Fame? And I don't know. I mean, we don't look at wins anymore. He had 200 wins for his career. He never won the Cy Young Award. He was the runner-up to the Cy Young Award in 2016. He had 4 years where he finished as a top Cy Young finalist. He pitched 9 postseasons, including that one with the A's, winning World Series and contributing big time to the 3 World Series rings that he got in 2007, in 2013, and 2016. Going to baseballreference.com, seeing the greatest website, the history of the planet Earth. In terms of the similarity scores they have, the pitchers that he resembles would be Dwight Gooden, David Cone, Tim Hudson, Justin Verlander, Roy Halladay, Jimmy Key, Zach Greinke, Cole Hamels, Kevin Brown, and John Lackey. And do you know what? I think that's fascinating that those are the 10 pitchers that he resembles the most in terms of a career, statistically. Now you have Halladay, who's in the Hall of Fame. The late Roy Halladay's in the Hall of Fame. Justin Verlander will probably be in the Hall of Fame. Greinke may or may not. But every single pitcher there is either a Hall of Famer or a borderline Hall of Famer, but people who had really great peaks. Dwight Gooden's peak was astonishing. David Cone's peak was the best in baseball. Tim Hudson's peak was legit Cy Young contender. Jimmy Key, same thing. Zach Greinke's peak was Cy Young winner. Cole Hamels, Kevin Brown, John Lackey, all of their peaks were tremendous. And what almost all of them have is they had very good peaks and a big time postseason if not pedigree, then at least highlight. David Cone was a big time pitcher in the postseason. Verlander was a great postseason pitcher when he was with Houston. Jimmy Key helped the Blue Jays and the Yankees win a World Series title. Cole Hamels was obviously a gigantic postseason pitcher in 2008 and also pitched really well in 2010. John Lackey, with his three World Series titles, and came up big in big games with the Angels, Red Sox, and with the Cubbies. And Kevin Brown, lest we forget, he was a huge pitcher for many, many years and had and pitched the complete game that pitched the Marlins into the World Series in 97 and pitched the Padres in the World Series in 98. So, and Lester kind of fits into that category of someone who had a wonderful career, a very high peak, and some great October moments, but not quite that Hall of Fame level of Smoltz or Randy Johnson or Pedro Martinez or Greg Maddux. You know, didn't quite get over the mountain, but amazing, tremendous career. Should get standing ovations for his entire life in Boston and Chicago. Just don't go to Oakland. But it was, you know, it's so funny that there's almost a binary sense that we have when we talk about players with really long careers, that it's either, are they in the Hall or not? Nah. And there is a tremendous gray area between Hall of Famer and forgettable. In fact, many of our favorite players that we have are not Hall of Famers, the people that we first got really attached to playing, you know, watching them play. Some of them came up big. And most of the time our postseason heroes, they're rarely Hall of Famers. They're usually the people who came up big in that big, huge moment. Yes, if you're a fan of, you know, Derek Jeter, he came up big in the postseason too. And I mean, there are examples that, you know, contradict what I'm saying. But it's so funny that when that question comes about, it almost means that you have to take a counter opinion on someone as if you're breaking them down in arbitration. I don't think John Lester is in the Hall of Fame. I wouldn't object if he is. I'm at the point in my life that whoever gets in the Hall of Fame gets in the Hall of Fame. If Lester gets in, I won't sit there and go like, how could you vote for him? I understand. You know, I understand. But I'm not a big Hall guy. I'm not a small Hall guy. I'm a medium Hall guy. I guess I like the Hall of Fame that Goldilocks would like. But, you know, Lester had a wonderful career and contributed big time to many, many championships. If you grew up a Yankee fan, let's say in the 70s and 80s, you're going to like Greg Nettles. You're going to like Rod and Guidry and Sparky Lyle, who all came up big, big in delivering World Series titles, multiple World Series titles to the Yankees. I don't think anyone's going to put them into the Hall of Fame, but you can still look at them and say, yeah, they were tremendous. You know, I listed David Cone and Dwight Gooden. Actually, Cone was not on the 86 team. I just remembered. But, you know, Gooden and Strawberry and Len Dykstra and Keith Hernandez and Bobby Ojeda and Jesse Orosco, all these people who were big contributors, Ron Darling, big contributors to the 86 Mets when they won the World Series. No one's going to put anyone I just listed into the Hall of Fame, but they're going to be beloved forever. There should almost be a Hall of Beloved. But John Lester would certainly be in the Hall of Beloved in Boston and in Chicago for that matter. So a wonderful career, incredibly easy person to root for. Like, I can't say he seemed like a good guy. Never met the man. But anyone who came back, beat the big C, and did so with a lot of humility and coming up big in some big games, it's worth tipping your hat to. You know, it's not always Hall of Famer or not. Yeah, it's one of the things that I think makes me the angriest about the, I had mentioned this before, the Harold Baines being put in the Hall of Fame, is that it's made people talk about players like Harold Baines as if they were bad. No, he had a terrific career. I would not have put him in the Hall of Fame, but he's in there. So let's all be okay with that. But it's funny. One of the players that Harold Baines was once traded for seems like he has as much of a chance to make the Hall of Fame as I do, which is, in case you're wondering, very, very small. Like John Lester, this player should be beloved in Chicago Cub fan by Chicago Cub fans for all time. And we're going to talk about him in the final segment of this episode. But I want to talk to you right now. It is the new year, and that means New Year's resolutions. And if yours is about getting fit or eating healthier, make sure to include Built Bar into your plan. Built Bar is a protein bar that tastes like a candy bar, maybe even better than a candy bar. Built Bar is made easier to stick to your resolution because it tastes great. You'll want to eat it, unlike other protein bars that can be chalky, waxy, or taste like a chemical spill. How do we know what a chemical spill tastes like? If you want to eat healthy, but you want to get so boring, you might think, hey, where's all the chocolate that I love? Well, Built Bars are 100% covered in chocolate, and they contain 130 calories, 4 grams of sugar, 4 grams of net carbs, 17 grams of protein. Compare that to a candy bar, which has around 240 calories, 30 grams of sugars, and dozens of carbs. Even if you're not a huge fan of working out, you can at least eat something that tastes good and is good for you. That way you can have a delicious Built Bar and it almost counts as a workout. There's so many great flavors to choose from: coconut almond, peanut butter brownie, raspberry cookies and cream, salted caramel, mint brownie, and many, many more. Built.com is always coming out with new limited time flavors, so check out Built.com to see what's new. Go to Built.com, use promo code LOCK15, get 15% off your order. Use promo code LOCK15 for 15% off at Built.com. Sammy Sosa is on the Hall of Fame ballot for the 10th time. Sammy Sosa's chances of getting to the Hall of Fame are about the same as me winning Best Supporting Actor at the Academy Awards this year. I didn't act in anything this year, so therefore, my chances are pretty slim. He got his first year on the ballot, he got 12.5%. His low watermark was 2015. He got 6.6. Last year, he got 17%. So he keeps hanging around the ballot, but not really. I mean, he would have to have a tidal wave of support, which I don't really see. Let me defend Sammy Sosa. Let me defend him for a little bit here. Does he have my Hall of Fame vote? I don't have a Hall of Fame vote. For everything I'm saying in terms of the Hall of Fame is purely conjecture. And I can say it safely from my podcasting studio here in Pasadena, California, overlooking the historic Rose Bowl. So I can say a lot of things and not be taken to task for it. I will say this, that absence of our knowledge of performance-enhancing drugs, he probably would have been in the first ballot. You know, he obviously was he hit 609 home runs. He's the only person in baseball history to hit 60 home runs in a season 3 times and led the league in home runs 2 other times. And led the league in total bases 3 times, led the league in runs scored 3 times. I know we're not supposed to look at that, but you know, he's had many, many tremendous seasons, silver slugger seasons during his 13 seasons with the Chicago Cubs. Now, we know that he failed an anonymous PED test in, I believe it was 2003, right around the time they started doing that testing. By 2005, he was, well, I mean, in 2004, he was gone from the Cubs. 2006, he sat out that season. By 2007, he played 114 games with Texas, his original team, and then had called it quits. So right around the time testing really started going, he was done with. And right around the time of the steroid hearings, the media savvy, always with a funny quote, Sammy Sosa, suddenly needed an interpreter and couldn't speak any English. Neither Sosa nor McGuire nor Rafael Palmeiro really distinguished themselves in those congressional hearings. Not sure why we were even having those, but fine, they existed, and things looked pretty bad for Sosa, who went from being a top 10 MVP player in 2003 to basically being out of baseball in 2006, coincidentally right around the time of steroid testing. And his time afterwards, you know, he's doing something strange with his skin. He looks like Mr. Mixelplick right now from the Superman comic books. Oh, so we also know that he had a corked bat and was seen in a videotape leaving Wrigley Field before a game was over, making fans boo, boo, boo him. Okay. Now, let me address a couple of things here. First of all, the nanosecond Ivan Rodriguez, Mike Piazza, and Jeff Bagwell were all rightfully elected to the Hall of Fame, to me, a lot of the steroid discussion kind of got deflated. Okay? I don't really, really care that much about performance-enhancing drugs. I don't want kids to use them. I want them to be monitored. I don't want it to be the Wild West. I want people to know what they're actually putting into their bodies. And if that will help them, fine. It can be done healthy, fine. You know, if they're breaking the law and doing stuff, yeah, I have an issue with that because it also leads to people doing things and young people doing things that are unhealthy and could kill them. Kind of against that. There's a big difference between breaking a law of a baseball game, like a spitball, an emery ball, or putting cork in your bat, and doing something that is against the law and that could cause harm to innocent kids. I understand there's a difference, but we also know, look at, did Jeff Bagwell fail a steroids test? No, he did not. Is he the single most obvious PED user in the history of Major League Baseball? Of course he was. Of course he was. He was, you know, skinny kid with no power, becomes teammates with Ken Caminiti, and balloons up to Paul Bunyan's size and becomes a Hall of Fame slugger. All during a period of time where everyone knew it was the Wild West in terms of performance-enhancing drug use, and is out of baseball right around the time that testing begins. Piazza, again, I don't blame PED users. He was, what, a 70th round draft pick? And, you know, muscles up and becomes the greatest home run hitting catcher in baseball history? Or, you know, who's, but we know Pudge Rodriguez was part of the whole Balco crew. So the minute those three, all three players who should be in the Hall of Fame got in, I think some of the other debates should be loosened up. I want A-Rod in the Hall of Fame and Ortiz. Any discussion about Clemens should be his off the field, what he has done in terms of other illegal things that have nothing to do with performance-enhancing drugs. That should be a discussion with Bonds as well, but certainly not their ability as baseball players. You know, they should be shoo-ins in terms of that. And there is something we all have to take into account with Sosa and for McGuire. We're not having this conversation if it wasn't for Sosa and McGuire. We're not. We're not talking about new ballparks being built. Yes, I know it started around Camden Yards, but there was an explosion that came around in the late 1990s, early 2000s. We saw attendance records being broken. Remember when people used to pat themselves on the back for passing 1 million or 2 million fans? Remember when people used to pat themselves on the back for a decent local radio or television contract? Not the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that have flowed into the game. Think about where baseball was in 1994 and 1995. For a while, it didn't exist. There was a strike of 94. There was the lockout of spring training in 95. And they were having trouble putting their butts in the seats. Ripken helped. Yes. The rise of the Yankees helped. Yes. The home run chase put people back into seats. I remember doing a comedy show at the Gotham Comedy Club in 1998, where I was down in the basement waiting for my time to go on stage. And Dana Eagle, who's a tremendous stand-up comic, was there with me. And another comic who I don't remember. Sorry, I like Dana. Dana was my friend. And we were watching. Dana, she wasn't even a baseball fan. And she was engrossed in the game that was being played. It was the day that McGuire passed Roger Maris. And then when the second the home run was hit, Chris Mazzilli, who I don't believe was a relative of Lee Mazzilli, who ran the Gotham Comedy Club, at least he did in 1998, came up to Dana and came up to me and said, when you go on stage, do not mention the fact that Mark McGwire just hit that home run, because people would then probably go storming out to want to see the clip. Remember, we couldn't watch them on our phones back in 1998. The McGwire-Sosa chase, which had a preview for it. There was a harbinger in 97 when McGwire and Ken Griffey Jr. looked like they may challenge Maris's record, but they didn't pass it. But then with the emergence of Sosa, who was the perfect yin to McGwire's yang. McGwire was basically, we can now say this name because we've all seen Cobra Kai, he was basically Billy Zabka. You know that Mark McGwire was the bully jock of his high school. He even looks like Billy Zabka, okay? You know, fair-haired bully, you know, jock from his high school who seemed a little humorless. He seemed a little like, oh, this is, woe is me, I'm hitting home runs, people are following me. In came Sosa, who was funny, who had literally a jump to his step when he hit a home run, who ran out to right field, pointing to the fans who went bananas. He had the great smile, he had a great laugh, he had funny quotes, he had this, the little thing he did where he kissed his fingers and kissed his, his chest. It was infectious, and he opened up McGwire, and McGwire became a little more fun. And so, oh, wait a minute, this is kind of fun, isn't it? And what did we all do in 1998? We had, and bear with me for a second, because you're not allowed to say this word, fun. And do you know who also had fun? Lots of young fans. It would be interesting as we, in about, what, in 6 years, it'll be the 20th anniversary. This will be the 20th anniversary? 30th. How the hell old am I? Oh my God. That's right. It'll be the 30th anniversary. Aren't I 26? It'll be the 30th anniversary of the McGwire Sosa chase. And using the rule of seven, I would be really curious to see how many people, young fans, who are currently baseball fans today, became fans because of Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire. How many people got hooked on baseball, the joy of baseball, from that year and from that chase? Was it fraudulent? Yeah. But guess what? Earlier that year, everyone went to see Titanic. They didn't build a big boat. Sometimes watching something that got you hooked on it, maybe if it was fraudulent and it got you into the ballpark, got you into Wrigley, got you into Fenway, got you into a Chavez Ravine to see the Dodgers play. What would baseball have been? And what would have recovered the game from, I'm never seeing another game again, which was a prevailing emotion in 1994, 1995, to record attendance by just 5-6 years later? There's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for the person who got everyone there. And it's funny, I rewatched The Godfather recently, and I was thinking Godfather 2 when Hyman Roth was talking about Mo Green and Las Vegas. And Mo Green is loosely based on Bugsy Siegel, the gangster who basically saw that there was a potential in Las Vegas for more than just a little bit of gambling to make it sort of a gangster empire. And Hyman Roth had the line, he invented Las Vegas, Nevada, and there's not a plaque or a statue there to honor his name. And I'm thinking about the Cubs, who have a completely refurbished Wrigley Field that will probably stand for another 50 years, a rabid fan base that ultimately brought in enough money to purchase a World Series title that was eluded the team for a century. And how much of that good fortune could be traced back to the flooding of the box office with Sammy Sosa. Is that enough to put him in the Hall of Fame? It's enough, in my opinion, to make him more than just someone you instantly dismiss. They use PEDs? Yeah, sure. There are guys in the Hall of Fame who clearly have. So I'm going to not go down that route. Did he do some bad things? Sure, but, you know, it's no Roberto Alomar. He's no Bobby Cox. So, Sammy, I'll defend you. Sure, if I had a ballot, I'd vote for him. Thanks for helping save baseball. And thanks for making us your first listen, as we're available on all your free podcasting platforms. Make your second listen be Locked On Bets with your boy Q and expert analysis from Lee Sterling. You can follow us on Twitter at Locked On MLB Pod. Same handle for Instagram. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. Talk about the legacy of John Lester and Sammy Sosa. They don't need a trip to Cooperstown to make them memorable in my eyes. This is Locked On MLB for the 16th day of January, 2022. Still getting used to saying that. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.